I call the meeting of the Health Policy Finance Committee to order. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This morning's meeting will be just to do a walkthrough of the Delete All Amendment AO6-1487. We'll take no motion or actions on it this morning. Tomorrow morning will be the time for the committee to act. Tonight will be an opportunity for public testimony after the legislative session, floor session. Let me just, however, sort of set the frame just a little bit. I want to remind members and the audience that we are dealing with a supplemental budget. The state of Minnesota does operate on a two-year biennial budget. We are fortunate in some respects to have any money to spend, given where we were about 3 years ago. But we do have a modest surplus available. I think that most of our colleagues in other committees would say, why is the Health Committee getting almost all of it? And to be perfectly honest, members, as you'll see as we go through the details, we're caught in sort of a situation which none of us would really want, but is really necessary to protect, and that is a significant growth in the number of sexual predators and civil commitment, and a significant growth in the mentally ill and dangerous, and also some growth in the middle area, and then finally a salary supplement that wasn't passed until after the budget was passed. So given those, you will see that we frankly didn't even have enough money for all of those needs, so we tried to be very selective and very highly prioritized in the bill that's going to be presented this morning. If I could call attention to the members, I think in your books you have first section is the spreadsheets, and I'm going to walk quickly through the Healthcare Access Fund spreadsheet first of all, and that I believe is called the 2006 Healthcare Access Fund Proposals, dated the 7th of April 2006. And I'm only going to highlight sort of the decision points so that just to bring those to your attention. When we go through the bills, of course, you'll see then some places where there's language that matches it. The first item on line 13 is a federal match. On many of the things that we do in the state, we get federal matching dollars, and this is just where those are collected and identified. You'll see in the current biennium, $688,000 of federal match dollars. On line 27 is the Minnesota Care Asset Verification. You'll see in the bill GAMC and Minnesota Care Asset Verification that we thought, frankly, that we had passed last year. Its placement in the bill, in the statutes, however, led some to conclude that we were only talking about medical assistance and not the other programs. So you'll see that we are doing that. The savings, however, are not until the next biennium. That is largely due to the interaction, of course, with HealthMatch. On lines 34 is the another portion of that verification. There's the expense, which is kind of a workaround expense. And then on line 35, if you recall, we reviewed in committee a whole host of proposals and changes necessary as a part of the Federal Deficit Reduction Act compliance. And then moving down to line 48, although the language will be being carried in the Jobs Committee, we're tracking here the $18 million from the Healthcare Access Fund for the Bioscience, University of Minnesota, and Mayo Bioscience Partnership. We are also tracking, which will be in the state government finance bill, and you recall the public employees insurance program, PEEP proposal, that $2.26 million will be, we're tracking that, but the bill itself will be in the state government finance. And then the final one is in our bill, and that's the MCHA assessment reduction. The numbers are different than what was reviewed with this committee. Frankly, that's just a matter of when we finally got all of the items fit in as a best fit, these were the numbers. And you'll see that we're projecting a savings of $87.5 million in the current biennium and then a total of $60 million in the next biennium. Now, members, that covers. And what I would suggest to members, I would certainly welcome if there are questions of clarification. There will be plenty of opportunities for debate and discussion tomorrow and hearing from people in testimony tonight, but certainly if there are, I'll be moving fairly quickly, but if members want to catch the attention of the chair and have any clarification questions, I'd be happy to deal with those. So I'm prepared to move now into the general fund, into the landscape version of the spreadsheet, which is the general fund spreadsheet. says 2006 Omnibus Bill, House File 3697, DE1, Net Fiscal Impact of Proposals. So I'll start with that. Mr. Chair, members, beginning first of all, on line 10 is the realization of $2.933 million from the final closeout. It turns out that although I think most of us thought that the Tobacco Endowment Fund had been closed out, as a matter of timing, other things, there still was some money remaining in that. So this would close out those monies and make those monies available to us. On line 12 is the Medicare Part D payer of last resort, the $570,000 that's actually been passed off the House floor already. On line 31 is the Healthcare Access Fund that we talked about already, so I won't review those three items. On 31, 32, and 33, I already spoke to those. Going to the next page, on the top of the next page, and we are tracking here, of course, the governor's proposal as compared to the House position. In the first item, the Veterans Home Board will actually review some of the detail, but you can see we were only able to fund part of the Veterans Home proposals, and I'll go into those when we get to those sections. And then we also cover the pretty much all of the health-related boards, since those were special revenue funds that we could cover those. And then also the emergency medical services on line 65, we are covering that one. Now, beginning on line 74, the governor had proposed a really significant mental health transformation from the Healthcare Access Fund. The bottom line is that we're not able to cover that. I don't happen to believe that we should be taking that from the Healthcare Access Fund. However, you'll see in another portion here that we did allocate $100,000 to sort of begin the process of study and formation. Going to the next page, starting in line 112, you'll notice that we covered almost all of the state-operated services security for the mentally ill and dangerous. And then on line 20, the sex offender program. You'll notice that we were a little bit short of the governor's. Frankly, this was just a matter of being able to fit things. I would comment, however, that if members will recall last year, it was just last year that we put these budgets in place, and there was a significant miss in the numbers. That's why we have these huge numbers before us now. These numbers, the 2 million or so reductions from what the governor requested, are less than 6% of those budgets. And I think if you look at last year, the miss was 2 to 3 times the numbers that were expected. So I'm hopeful that we're within the error range of what those programs could be. On line 131, it might appear as though we've made a reduction in the MEDO coverage. The fact of the matter is that we've not, and these are just updated fiscal notes. So that's just a matter of what the there's an increase in the amount of revenue above expected, and that's why we have that $479,000 savings. And then we did fully cover the state-operated services salary deficit. As I understand it, that salary deficit was actually for current staff, and we have that covered. We were not able to cover on line 146 the study on epidemiology of children and juveniles. On line 152, we did encompass entirely the Federal Deficit Reduction Act. As you recall, when we went through this fairly comprehensive language, and that is in the bill, virtually every bit of it was required as a matter of matching up to that. There is a piece in here that is part of what Representative Nadler did on long-term care that's an adjunct to it, but I think that's consistent with the Deficit Reduction Act as well. Going now to the next page, on line 176, we are doing, this is part of that asset verification that we passed last year, and this is just another portion of those savings. On line 185, the exempting certain GAMC groups from the shift, we were not able to cover that. The line 193, pay for performance for healthcare providers, not able to cover that. The 201 is the proposed governor proposal Minnesota Pharmacy Access Program that we were not able to cover as well. And then on line 210 is the Medicare Part D implementation support, and again, we were not able to cover that. And you'll notice, by the way, that the last two of those were coming from the Healthcare Access Fund, and in part, this represents a feeling that these are not legitimate health care access fund expenses. On line 218 is the portion of the bill that I carried on verification using the SAVE program for immigration status and also a requirement for reporting. On line 226 is the language portion. Unfortunately, we were not able to allocate and appropriate any money for, as you recall, the shortfall in the current biennium. But what we are covering here, though, is getting language in place so that the dental providers can at least plan better and have a clearer picture. One of the problems that people had was that they were sort of caught in midstream. So we did carry enough language to make that change in process. Moving on to the next page, the Pharmacy Payment Reform Advisory Committee and Study is covered, Representative Powell's bill. And then on line 237 is the mental health study. The language was language that Representative Weber provided to us, but that is a kind of a placeholder at least for continuation of some focus, and that is that is coming from the general fund. In line 243 is Representative Weber's cost containment, part of the cost containment that we are covering. On line 249 is coverage for the governor's proposal on a up to 5% incentive payment for nursing facilities in the future. Line 256 is a coverage for the Benton, Sherburn, and Stern counties nursing facilities. Those who have been around for a while know this has been sort of a long-standing issue that we thought we had taken care of. This will now put that so that it is in fact taken care of. On line 263, although there's no expenditures in this biennium, this would be coverage for the Aguaching conveyance property rate, and that's for the nursing facility there. On line 269, I think I already mentioned about the alternative care. No, I guess I did not mention it. We're not able to cover the alternative care program shortfall. On line 276 is the quarterly case mix. We had a number of alternatives. I wish there were easy alternatives than this, but it's sort of hard to argue with, even though I think some would argue that our case mix system has some flaws in it, legitimately so, and I would highly advocate this committee revisit this issue in the next biennium to try to rectify that. But in the meantime, for the purposes of the constituents who have been before us and fairness, that at least let's move to a quarterly assessment rather than every 6 months. Line 281 is the ICFMR study and plan. Next page, on line 287, is the Crestview nursing home moratorium exception. Now we move into the Department of Health. Starting on line 300, we did put $1 million of general fund. Again, I do have a difference of opinion with the governor's bill as far as where the money should come from, and we did scrape together. At least I think we kind of keep this issue alive by putting $1 million available through the health department on influenza preparedness. We were not able to cover the governor's proposal on line 307 for the e-health initiative. And similarly, on line 313, the governor's proposal for immigrant health. On line 319 is a bill which is going on its own, but we are tracking. We will also carry the language on the abortion notification reporting, Representative Broad's bill. Starting on line 324 is the assisted living definition regulation, considerable amount of language and a coverage out of the special revenue in the first biennium of $140,000, and you'll see language ongoing as to how that will be covered by assessments to the assisted living facilities. Line 330 is the Wilkin bill on starvation and dehydration prevention. On line 335 are the elements of healthcare cost containment in the bill that I carried that actually ends up with a little bit of savings in the healthcare access fund, that is. Line 341 is a exempting schools from the hospitality fee. As you can see, that affects a special revenue fund, and we did not replace it with general fund. On the next page, the Veterans Home Board, here's where I'll go through the detail now with you. On line 353, we were not able to cover the consultant study recommendations, nor the line 363, which is the quality assurance Those two are pretty much the result of the concerns and problems that existed in the Minneapolis nursing home, and then subsequently there were studies done in other nursing homes. We did, however, cover the operational shortfall. Part of my personal logic in this is that I think you and I know that if we had any of nearly 400 nursing homes in Minnesota that had survey difficulties, there would be likely the actually fines for those nursing homes as opposed to additional money. And these nursing homes, although certainly they do take care of some of our most important people, have already relatively high rates. But in the end, frankly, it's a matter of how much money is available in this non-budget year. And then I already indicated that we had covered all of the board operation adjustments and the Emergency Medical Services Board. And that concludes review of the spreadsheets. If there's no questions, I'll proceed to go through the bill itself. Mr. Chair, members, it's not my intention to go through element by element because we've heard every one of these bills in our committee, but at least to give you kind of a framework. And I didn't have the summary in time this morning, so if you'll forgive me, I'm going to walk through the actual bill language itself and just sort of give you the framework of where things are and any little bit of commentary along the way. So beginning in the bill, in Article 1, which begins on line 1.4, which is long-term care and mental health, the first section, Section 1, is a part of the quarterly assessment for nursing homes. On page 2, Section 2, is the Crestview exception, and that actually goes all the way to page 9. So you can turn to page 9. Section 3, which begins on the bottom of page 9, is the exception, which then the language is actually on the bottom of page 10 for the Cass Lake nursing facility exception. On the top of page 11, Section 4, is the mental health study that we mentioned before, a total of about $100,000 allocated to that. The state participation is less because of some federal monies that match that. Section 5 on page 11 is the rate increase for the Stern, Sherburn, and Benton County nursing facilities. Section 6 on the top of page 12 is the incentives for nursing facilities picked up from the governor's proposal. That goes over into page 13. Section 7 in the middle of page 13 is the other part of the quarterly assessment, case mix assessments. On the bottom of that page, Section 8, is the ICFMR plan and study. On page 14 now begins the state health care programs. Section 1 is one portion of using the SAVE program for verification of eligibility, immigrant eligibility. Section 2 on page 15 is the reporting requirement when undocumented immigrants are discovered. Section 3 is a portion of language from the Department of Human Services regarding county-based purchasing, changing care systems to manage care. Section 4 on the bottom of that page is the critical access dental language, which the really operative part of that is on page 18. The middle of page 18, starting at line 1811, is the language that this committee has reviewed, which requires the department to provide a plan so that the dentists involved in the program have a clear picture of what lies ahead for them. Section 5 on the bottom of that page is the language that we thought was covered, and it turns out it was in the MA section, so now it's being put in for the GAMC section in Section 5, and this just requires eligibility verification. Section 6 on the top of page 19 is a continuation of that, and now in Section 6 and Section 7 is extending that as was originally intended to Minnesota Care. On the top of page 20, Section 8, is the contingent provider tax reduction language. In the bottom of that page, Section 9, is the language from the agency, from Department of Human Services and the governor on county-based purchasing to give more flexibility to the commissioner in the case of what's called, I think now, single plan versus single source. On the top of page 21, section 10, is the Pharmacy Payment Reform Advisory Committee. And that, let's see, that continues into the next page, all the way to page 23. The repealer on page 23 on section 11 is just repealing some obsolete language. Article 3, the healthcare federal compliance. That first section there is dealing with that federal deficit reduction. I think we're going to find that a whole lot of the remaining, I will only bring to your attention on page 25 is some additional language that, as I indicated earlier, is from Representative Aber's bill on long-term care partnership. But I believe it's entirely consistent with the DEFRA, or the Deficit Reduction Act, from the federal government. As a matter of fact, this long-term care partnership language goes all the way to page 41. And I don't intend to go back through, because we have, this committee has already reviewed that. So we can go now to page 41. And on section 23 now, on page 41, this is also related to DEFRA. These are the other sections now beyond the long-term care partnership. There is actually a part of long-term care partnership in the remaining, but members can certainly read through every word of this if you'd like, but all the way to page 65 is the DEFRA compliance. So we'll skip now to page 65 in the bill. And on page 65, the repealer there has to do with replacement of language in the long-term care partnership. Now we begin on page 65, Article 4, the Department of Health. The first section there is has to do with the abortion notification. Section 2 deals with the, I believe it was cleansing bill on the birth record. And then we switch over on page 66, picks up again on abortion notification. And there again, I'm not intending to run through what we've already reviewed as a committee. We've just picked up that bill as is. That goes to the top of page 70. On the top of page 70, section 4 is a small section. If you recall, we had a bill on some the right kind of connectors for water being flashed back at campgrounds. That's what that section 4 is. Then we move now to section 5, which are the sections dealing now with starvation and dehydration prevention. That begins on page 70 and goes all the way to page 73. So we'll skip now to page 73. At the bottom of page 73 is the Assisted Living Bill of Rights. This is the, if you recall, a fairly significant proposal coming from the various advocate groups on assisted living. And again, we have covered that in detail. I think there's liable to be an amendment here just to clarify sort of the appropriation section, but otherwise, this is as we reviewed in committee. This goes all the way to page 90, so we can skip now to page 90. On page 90, section 24 is a continuation of the abortion reporting, the Laura Broad bill, and that goes down to section 25. At section 25 is the Representative Dean proposal on fetal anomaly exemptions, and that goes to the top of page 93. On the top of page 93, section 28, is the Pharmacist Conscience Bill, Representative Emmer's bill. Going on to page 94, section 29 is the exemption to the statewide hospitality fee for schools, Representative Cypress bill. Continuing that page, section 30 is another section of the Laura Broad bill, which would prohibit use of state funds except as matching federal requirements for abortion. And then on the top of page 95, section 31, are revisers' instructions, and this is just cleanups from the assisted living sections that are in the bill. Article 5 is health care cost containment. Sections 1 through 4 are the language allowing for-profit HMOs operation in Minnesota. Section 5 and Section 6, I think, are from Representative Ingber's work, which would allow higher deductibles and higher out-of-pocket maximums for HMOs. And I believe in the page 97, Section 7 is another section dealing with lifetime maximum, and then also has a provision in Section 7 which says that when the lifetime maximum is reached, people would be, I think, essentially automatically available for the high-risk pool, the MCHA program. Section 8 is the bill, or the language, which deals with the reduction in the MCHA assessment. Section 9 at the bottom begins a section on provider cost disclosure. And what the top of the page there, that's subject to the requirements, that 62J823 is a new section which places some requirements on hospitals. And then there's a section in the middle of the page in that section that deals with pharmacy reporting. Section 10 is a section from Representative Aber's work on evidence-based practices and standards, allowing health-related boards set up to publish some of those. On page 99, section 11 is another section from Representative Aber's bill on electronic billing assistance. Section 12 is a more on disclosure. This is just some cleanup language from areas that we had in the past, and one of the things it does, in, starting at line 27, is include health plans to have responsibility in this reporting. And then on the bottom of the page, section 13, is the hospital transparency, or the hospital pricing transparency that I mentioned before. And that continues on to page 100. On page 101 at the top, section 14 is from Representative Aber's bill calling for administrative efficiency reporting. In the middle of that page at section 15 is an item that I think was in a bill I carried, which allows plans that have a small portion of the market to be able to pool for purchasing. Section 16 is just clarification on allowing where there are restrictions that discounted payments are provided for health providers so they can do charity and other kinds of care and give discounts there. Section 17 is, I believe, to be kind of characterized as a skinning down of the service co-op language, Representative Abel. I think that would be fair to say, so that it provides some framework for them and does require rebidding contracts for insurance, those kinds of things. Section 18 is a section, again, from Representative Abler, suggesting agency websites. Page 104. Section 19 is also from Representative Bill, report on uncompensated care. That continues over through to page 106. And on section 20, is it looks to me like just some clarifying language on the explanation of pharmacy benefits, just saying that it should be the pharmacy's own usual and customary price. Section 21 is a section from Representative Abler on a directory of licensees. Section 22 is another section from Representative Abler's healthcare cost containment work on price disclosure reminder being sent out. Section 23, as well, from Representative Abler, asking the, or I guess enabling the Commissioner of Health to consult with others on the whether or not there's a need for action on infections in hospitals and other facilities. Page 24, or page 107, I'm sorry, section 24, is another section from Representative Abler on cost containment studies looking at alternative and complementary health care. Subdivision 2 of that is studies relating to community health clinics. And section 25 is the medical malpractice insurance report. On page 108, section 26 is the continuation of, remember the wonderful discussion we've had on this thinking outside the box on single price? Well, this at least keeps the idea alive from a point of viewing studied. And then section 27 is the repealing of the hospital capital expenditure reporting. And then I believe, actually, there's another piece in there. Because we had a rewrite on that charity care That's been repealed here as well, and that replaced by language that we previously reviewed. That's the 62Q251. Article 6 is forecasts, and if you really want Ms. Zimmerman to go through the forecast, she would be happy to, but this is what I believe we've already have on the floor, and this is just, it's been pretty much customary in all of the finance bills to carry those. And then starting on page 110, Article 7 are the appropriations, but since we already went through those in the spreadsheet, I don't intend to go through them again here. Those are all consistent. The only thing I would point out to you is that on page 117, line 24, there's a blank, and if you recall from the spreadsheet, that blank is now filled in with a number of $2.933 million. We'll be doing that in office amendment tomorrow when we bring up the bill, but just for your information. And members, you know what I was curled up with this weekend, so are there any questions?
Thank you, Representative Bradley. Any clarifying questions? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There being none, and I don't mean to put that off, there aren't, then I would just review sort of the plan from here. We will reconvene after session, probably 4 o'clock, or listen on the floor if it would be a different time, that based on the session. And we will be taking at that time public testimony. We've asked people to try to limit their comments to a couple of minutes so that we have an opportunity for everybody to testify. Most of these, virtually all of these, frankly, have been bills that have been heard, so it's not that we haven't had an opportunity for discussion, but we certainly want, now that the final bill's in front of us, though, to have an opportunity for the public to testify. And then the plan would be tomorrow morning, we meet at 10 o'clock, and that would be the markup opportunity for the committee. I'm sure that there won't be anything more than just office amendments to clean up the bill, and that will be done. Maybe not. So that'll be the process from here. And tomorrow's we'll also reconvene in the afternoon if we need to continue our work. That's the plan.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. Quickly, we want to approve the minutes from the April 4th meeting. Representative Eakin, move the meeting. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Very good. And keeper materials in your folders. I think we're going to stand in recess and listen up for Representative Bradley on the floor. Otherwise, we'll plan to be back here at 4 o'clock.
We'll call this meeting back to order. We are going to take public testimony. And I believe if we can keep the testimony to about 2 minutes apiece, and members of the committee, if we have questions, let's keep them to clarifying questions. We'll have plenty of time tomorrow to duke it out and debate the issues. So if you have clarifying questions for the testimony, testifiers, we can do that. Otherwise, we'll zip through this agenda. So I'm going to make a quick change here. If we have someone from the Medical Association that had to leave early, if we could get you up here first, Dr. David Luer. Welcome to the committee, Doctor. If you could state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Dr. David Lear. I'm a family physician from Cloquet. I'm currently the president of the Minnesota Medical Association. Because my time is short, I'm going to focus on a few areas of this bill. First of all, the NMA strongly supports Article 2, Section 8, which tries to right-size the 2% tax. Year after year, this tax, which funds the Health Care Access Fund, has raised more than is needed for the programs that it's intended to fund. And in fact, over the last 4 years, more than $400 million has either been transferred out of the Health Care Access Fund or used for new spending that was not originally paid for the sick tax. Both the Department of Revenue and the Minnesota Taxpayer Association have shown that the sick tax is one of the most regressive taxes that we have. And it directly adds to the overall health care costs. Most legislators, including members of this committee, have publicly stated again, time and again, that they would like to eliminate the sick tax. To set the tax at a level that's tied to current funding needs is a step in the right direction. I want to personally say that I've lived in Minnesota my entire 57 years, have gone to school here, trained, have been in residency. I considered leaving the state when this tax came because I felt it was an unjust and not workable tax. I did decide to stay. But secondly, we support the language to right-size the sick tax, we are disappointed that the House File 3697 continues to trend of using the Health Care Access Fund as a catch-all fund to pay for new health care spending. The total of new spending recommended to come from the Health Care Access Fund in this biennium for programs not previously funded by the sick tax is over $107 million and over $167 million for the next two biennium. House File 3697 would use $87 million from the Health Care Access Fund for MSHA this biennium and $60 million next biennium, and would increase the amount that can be transferred from the Health Care Access Fund to the General Fund by over $30 million each biennium. With all the new Health Care Access Fund spending obligations before the legislature this year, the right sizing provision will have little impact in actually reducing the sick tax. Finally, I'd like to comment on the provision related to the artificial hydration and nutrition in Article 4. Although Representative Wilkin has attempted to narrow the focus of his original bill, the MMA remains opposed to some of the language in the House File 3697. This bill would interfere with patients' and families' ability to decide what is best for them. In an ideal world, I would love for each of my patients to have a living will or advance directive, and indeed I ask each of them to do so. However, this is often not the case. And quite often in my practice, I have to sit down and make the very difficult decisions with the family in trying to decide what would be the best course, what the patient would desire. And I think the families do a good job in making these decisions. I've been through this personally with my two parents. I've been through it many times with my patients. The MMA firmly believes that the best way to determine what a patient would want in the last days of their lives is if there is no advance directives, is for the family to be directly involved in making those decisions and not the government. Mr. Chair, I've stayed within my 2 minutes. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great job, Doctor. Thank you. Members, any clarifying questions? See none. Thank you.
Thank you for all your work.
We'll go back to the top of the list. Aaron Sexton with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce.
Welcome. Chair, members. My name is Aaron Sexton. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Not here to tell you anything I haven't told you before. I'd once again like to express support for the provisions in this bill that provide relief from the MSHA assessment and also the provisions that create more price transparency within our healthcare system. As you all know, reducing the MSHA assessment is one of the things that you can all do to provide direct and tangible premium savings to small and medium-sized employers. As we've seen, there's a very small portion of the market that pays this MSHA assessment, and it's falling on those who are the least able to pay this assessment, our small and medium employers. As they struggle to continue to offer health care benefits to their employees, anything that we can do to make that easier and more able for them to continue to offer those benefits, I would encourage you to do. And I think this is one thing that we can do to provide, to give them the ability to continue to offer benefits to their employees. Secondly, I'd just like to express support briefly for the price transparency provisions. As we move more and more toward more consumer-driven products that are out there, HSAs and so on, consumers need this information to become better, smart shoppers. It's hard to give someone all these dollars to go out and say, spend them as you please, but not give them any information on cost and quality. We think the provisions in here help provide that information on cost to those consumers and will help make them better shoppers in the market. We know it's hard to shop if you're going to have a heart attack, but for those of us that are going in for a sore throat or cold, that information is very valuable and will help us make better healthcare decisions and be smarter users of our healthcare dollars. So I encourage you to support those provisions and we'll take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any clarifying questions? Seeing none, thanks. We'll move on to Bruce Nelson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I am Bruce Nelson from ARM. We're an organization of providers who support people in the DD, CADI, TBI, CAC, waivers, ICFSMR, SILS, and some PCA services. I want to thank you for including two provisions that are critical to providers who support people with disabilities. First is a plan calling for a future of the ICFMR system. It's a system that's been really unstable for the past 4 years, largely as a result of some changes and cuts that were made as a result of the deficit the state was in. It calls for a plan that would pull together all the stakeholders, who, including families and consumers, to put together a plan to bring forward to the 2008 legislature. And the plan would address consumer choice and needs, funding, who can best be served in an ICFMR, and what the capacity is. And so hopefully by 2008 we'll have a plan that would be adopted that brings stability and certainty to the 2,000 people who now live in ICFMR, and certainty and stability as well to their families and to providers. The second provision is a rider about PCA services on page 112 of the bill. It's an issue that was worked out between the Department of Human Services and providers. It was a problem that initially was addressed in a bill by authored by Representative Bradley. And ultimately, it was a very complex problem, but ultimately at the heart of the problem was the cost of documenting PCA hours in group homes and under regulations in federal Medicaid law. The solution is an allowance for an increase in the limits and the waivers, and I should remind you, at no cost. There will be an increase in the limits if this rider is adopted to allow people who are now served by PCAs and group homes to get a waiver. At no cost, as the expenditure basically takes money from one bucket or a couple other buckets and puts it into the waiver buckets. And with that, I want to thank you, Representative Bradley, members of the committee, for those items in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Members, clarifying questions? Seeing none, thanks. We'll move on to Lynn. I have to apologize for the names. Gruber? All right. One for one. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, thank you for the opportunity to address you this evening. I speak about Article 5, Section 8 of the bill, which relates to health care cost containment and specifically providing the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association with an appropriation basically from the Health Access Fund should there be a surplus. Very briefly, the MCHA, Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, is the state's high-risk pool for individuals that get denied coverage because they have a pre-existing condition. We have about 30,000 members that are in the pool from all 87 counties. Right now, the way we are funded is premiums are above market, and that covers about 50% of what we need to run the pool. The other 50% is in statute. We are allowed to assess the insurance industry for the remainder, which usually are about $100 million of losses in the year. But the true payers of the assessment are small business people and individuals who are buying an insured product. And the reason I say that is because self-insurance, self-funded plans cannot be assessed. So this is a very wise way to help fund MCHA by using the Health Care Access Fund. It's a very broad-based tax, and we think this is the way to help make a more equitable funding source for MCHA. We are very appreciative of that section of the statute, or of the bill. Thank you.
Members, clarifying questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Next on my left, we have a couple from the Dental Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dick Dirks. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Dental Association, which represents about 3,000 dentists, about 83% of the dentists in the state. I'm here to talk to you this evening about the Critical Access Dental Provider Program, which is a four-year-old program that provides enhanced reimbursements for qualifying nonprofit and private dental offices under the MA Medical Assistance Program. Over the last 4 years, this program has been very helpful in stabilizing dental access and maintaining the level of care that is existent in this area, and addresses the problem of the severe underfunding of care in the dental arena. We noticed that you were unable to fund the Critical Access Dental Provider Program out of general fund dollars in this bill. We appreciate the effort to do so. I would encourage you to consider funding the Critical Access Dental Provider Program out of the Healthcare Access Fund. Dentists contribute considerably more into the Healthcare Access Fund than is paid back out for dental care. And most dentists would like to see the dollars that they pay into the fund, into the out of the provider tax, used to pay for dental care. The Critical Access Dental Provider Program is a way that a portion of the excess tax paid by dental offices can be used to pay for the needed care for medical assistance patients throughout the state. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that source of funding. The Critical Access Program itself is being reduced by about half in 2006 because of administrative actions by the Department of Human Services. That the reduction of one half will have a considerable impact on access to dental care, and will make it very difficult for dentists who are seeing a lot of the patients out there to continue seeing as many patients as they have seen over the last few years. So I would encourage you and ask your consideration of funding the Critical Access Dental Provider Program as you proceed through the rest of the legislative session. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you, members. Clarifying questions?
Mr.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Harris, I would like to know, and I'm sympathetic, you know that.
Yes.
The language that we did put in had the clause that deals with trying to provide a better, is that still helpful, though, to dentists, to critical access dentists, to have that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, yes, we very much support the language that you have about annually reviewing the formula for the Critical Access Program. We support that and the funding that you put in for the Department of Human Services, too. They need the help, but hopefully you'll be able to find a way to fund the program itself as it has been.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I heard you say that dentists put a lot more money into the health care access fund than what they get back. Do you know how much that is?
Mr. Dirks. Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin. In 2004, the last year for which we have complete figures, dentists paid about $30 million into the health care access fund. What's tougher to figure out is how much actually was paid out for dental services, because it doesn't all get reported by dollars by the department. But our guess is that it's probably $12 to $15 million that goes back out into dental care. So there's a substantial surplus that dentists pay in.
Well, then,
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, do you support then some reinstatement of the dental benefits that were cut in the last couple of years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, we do support as much of a dental benefit as can be provided to needy patients.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the list is Dr. Helgeson.
Mr. Chair and
welcome to the committee.
Committee members, my name is Dr. Michael Helgeson. I'm the CEO of Appletree Dental, one of the critical access provider organizations here in Minnesota. And I really appreciated the opportunity to testify earlier, and I promise to get right to the point very quickly this evening. I'm here to urge each of you to continue your efforts to help save the Critical Access Dental Provider Program. You created this program 4 years ago to provide access to dental care for Minnesota Public Program patients by providing supplemental funding to sustain critically needed dental providers. The Critical Access Provider Program has been successful in accomplishing your goals, but now this program faces an incapacitating cut of more than 50%. Appletree Dental estimates that the current cut of about $3.2 million in state funding from last year's spending level might result in the loss of dental care to about 60,000 children, disabled adults, and frail elderly who have nowhere else to turn. So I'm concerned about these people first and foremost. Where will they end up getting care? I'm also concerned that damage to the safety net will linger for years to come if we don't restore this funding. And it does appear, as Dick Dirks mentioned, that House File 3697 lacks an appropriation to restore the funding cuts themselves. We appreciate everything that's in the bill, but really restoring the funding cut is the primary goal for the program. And an appropriation of $3.2 million is necessary to keep the program spending at the 2005 level. So I urge you to take action to reverse this $3.2 million cut, and want to highlight that for the safety net, these payments make the difference between sinking and staying afloat. So thank you very much for the opportunity to testify again, and please feel free to contact me if you have any questions.
Thanks. Any clarifying? Representative Goodwin.
Thank you. And I heard you say that 60,000 people lost dental care. Is that correct or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative, based on AppleTree's statistics and looking at a cut of $3.2 million in these supplemental payments, if those providers reduce their services in proportion to the cut, 60,000 individuals would lose their only source of care at these critical clinics.
Also, Mr. Chair, so let me get this straight. For just $3.2 million, you could serve 60,000 people.
Dr. Helgeson.
Yes, because these are supplemental payments.
Right.
And they take you from about 50% of a normal fee to about 60% of a normal fee. 60% of a normal fee can sustain these practices. 50% cannot. So it's a small amount of money, and also it leverages equal federal dollars.
Ah.
So every dollar you put in leverages a federal dollar.
And then one follow-up question. And then are there health problems? I always hear there's health problems that can be caused by the lack of dental care and other physical health problems, heart problems, so forth. Is that correct?
Dr. Helgeson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that is correct. Recently, there was a study looking at pneumonia among nursing home patients. This is a major cause of death, and which the dental plaque, the germs that live in the dental plaque, were actually identified using DNA, kind of like CSI. They were able to study the infective agent in the pneumonia, and in hospitalized nursing home residents, more than half of the cases were caused by the germs in the dental plaque. It's only one area, low birth weight preterm babies. Chronic infection of the gum is one of the main contributing factors. Those are just two that I could highlight.
And, Mr. Chair, final follow-up. And, tell me about the cardiac issue.
Yes.
Dr. Ellison.
Thank you. I apologize for the lack of skill with the format here, but yes, there are a number of studies linking chronic infections in the mouth to heart disease. In fact, there have been some recent studies that show that the chronic infection process in the mouth actually contributes to the thickening of the coronary artery walls, which is one of the early stages. And then there were studies done at the University of Minnesota showing timing of heart attacks related to the spike of bacteria flowing through the bloodstream in the morning when people brush their teeth, and all that bacteria gets in through their bleeding gums into their blood vessels and can actually contribute to the heart attack timing itself.
Thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, Dr. Helgeson, you used the word as well, and I was sort of just going to leave it alone, but since there's been some clarifying discussion, I think it would be fair to say that the funding was not, in fact, actually cut. What happened was that the account that was set up, the full appropriation was used, and you could say, well, it was poor planning, whatever, but we ran out of money way ahead of time, therefore they had to cut back rates. So, I mean, I understand from the individual dentist, but in fact, the full appropriation was there. There were no reductions in appropriation, just ran out sooner than expected. I just did that for clarification.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Dr. Helgeson.
Yes, I agree with that. That is true.
All right, thank you. Pete Johnson, Mr. Pete Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Peter Johnson. I represent NFIB, National Federation of Independent
businesses here in Minnesota with its 17,000 members. I just want to echo Ms. Gruber's remarks regarding some of the assessments that are sort of an inequality with the premiums that are paid by our members. It sounds like only a small amount, 2% each year, but of course over a decade, that's 20% more our members have to pay than large insurers that are self-insured. So we just ask that you, with your hard work, our members appreciate all the time you put in, that you consider this provision, and I want to thank Representative Bradley for that provision as well. Thank you.
Members, clarifying questions? Representative Goodwin.
Thank you. And I was going to ask you, with the 2% tax on a small business, we want to get this straight, that you're saying that comes back to you through the insurance premium, especially the insurance industry that pays that 2%, and you're saying it comes back to small employers. Is that correct?
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, what for your average, I don't know what size your average business is that belongs to NFIB, but what if that was passed directly down to, what is your average size business?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I don't have that figure with me right now.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Goodwin, it's Peter Johnson.
Peter what?
Johnson.
Johnson. Okay, that should be easy enough to remember. Sorry about that. I don't know what your average retailer pays for health care, either those that have it. I know that there's quite a few that don't have it, and because they can't afford it. But how much would that 2% on their premiums for your average retailer actually mean a difference? How much difference would that mean in a year? I heard it was like $60 a year would be about the amount. Is that correct, do you think? Am I close?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I think your figures are correct. I can't give you any more accurate information than that.
Thank you.
Representative Emmer.
Never mind. It's not worth it.
No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
We'll move on to Dennis O'Gorman. And is it Jerry Kaiser also?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dennis O'Gorman. I am the chairman of the Commander's Task Force. And Jerry?
My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the president of Roseville, Minnesota. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. Between Dennis and myself, we represent all of the veterans organizations of the state of Minnesota. That's 440,000 voters, their spouses and their families. So that's over a million voters. And so we're here to talk about this particular bill.
I would just like to say one more time that all of you, we want to tell our story one more time. Many of you have the Commander's Task Force booklet, which represents the supplemental that we're talking about here today. Also, I know I've had the privilege to tour many of you through our fine veterans home, especially Representative Bradley and some of his team. I'm sure many of you were there. And the reality that you see at the veterans home is really what we need this money for. And what we thought was going to be a banner year, we're hearing now that the sabers are rattling and maybe we're not going to do as well for veterans, and that's really, really hard for us, because what you all saw on the floors of the Minnesota veterans homes is reality. We hope that the small bumps in the road that we have overcome and moved past are not a deterrent to getting help with our veterans homes. Mr. Chairman, committee members, reality is what you have seen during your visit. Our supplemental request translates to hundreds of frail elderly residents, most a part of the greatest generation, that without your help may have no place in the inn. 85 and older is the fastest growing veterans population in the nation. We can write books about these folks, how they saved the world and built a nation, but we need the appropriations to care for him who has borne the brunt of battle. And these folks are in the twilight of their lives. These are real faces behind the supplemental need. I'm told today that the Hastings Veterans Home admitted their first Iraqi Freedom Combat veteran to their facility. The Commander's Task Force, in its legislative agenda, in here today, is asking for you to provide the necessary full funding to ensure that our veterans' homes can operate. Providing care to our elderly, sick, and disabled veterans is part of the cost of national defense and should be a top priority for your state government. I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding repair and betterment or supplemental funding at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, both Dennis and I are Vietnam veterans. And when I looked at this and we saw $759,000, when we asked for the supplemental amount of $12 million, the governor asked for $7.4 million, I was taken aback. We were abandoned when I came back from Vietnam, and I almost feel like we're being abandoned now. I understand it's all about money, but these gentlemen are in the twilight of their years. They're our parents. And we're going to have more and more of these gentlemen and these widows showing up at these at the veterans' home. There's 950 of them in the state of Minnesota. I just can't imagine that we're going to have to close one of these if this, in fact, happens. I know that you got to go to a conference committee and maybe money will magically appear there, but I don't know how that works. Maybe I'm just naive, but I just don't understand how this got cut down to $759,000. It's not rocket science. We're asking for these ladies and gentlemen that are being taken care of at these veterans' homes, and I've been out there. These veterans' homes could not function if it wasn't for the volunteerism of the VFW, the American Legion, the AMVET, the Vietnam Veterans, all the organizations. They do a wonderful job. And I just don't understand how this comes about. Maybe I'm just naive. And I'm asking you to put this money back into this bill so we can adequately take care of these ladies and gentlemen at these veterans' homes and not abandon them like I feel we are.
We've come a long way since the one singular old soldier's home. We are under more codes and reviews and surveys than we've ever had before, and this is where the brunt of the money falls, and we need to address it. Thank you.
Thank you both. Members, clarifying questions. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't necessarily need to know, but if you could follow up with what the some kind of average per diem that we have in the various veterans' homes are. The regulations you talk about are similar across all of Minnesota for nearly 400 nursing homes. So if, because I know it's kind of tough here, but it'd be a little unfair to our taxpayers to say that we don't care, because we care a lot. And I think that would be fair of all of our taxpayers to say, but if you could give me information on what our current annual average or something like that are, or if you could even get more refined than that, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, we can do that, sir.
If I can may say that, the 50% of the money that comes in comes from the federal government for the supply of the monies that are taking care of this. The next part of it comes from the constituents themselves who are paying for it, and then the rest of it comes from the state of Minnesota. And that is the breakdown of it. If we don't have the federal money, obviously that per diem coming in is a huge amount of dollars. We don't have the patients, we don't get the money. And that's what it comes down to. I ask you again to reconsider this, and thank you.
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do we lose federal money if we don't put enough? Is there matching dollars required or for the best?
We have
Mr. Gorman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have a lot of programs that are on the leverage dollars through the federal. Some of that, which just came back to the state in the form of $12 million, by the way, was recently presented by the Secretary of the Federal VA, Secretary Nicholson. This is a supplement that we're asking for to continue, and this is not in the form of a federal dollars coming back on this request.
Mr. Chair, clarification on that issue. You said $12 million came back from the federal government to the state. Did that come to the veterans' homes, or did that come to the general fund, or where did that come?
Mr. Berman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe it did was presented from the Secretary to the Governor Pawlenty, so it's in the state coffers at this time.
So, Mr. Chair, not only are we not funding the veterans' homes appropriately, but we are using the federal funds to help the general fund. Would that be a correct statement?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, well, I would say that the state in the beginning funded partially or some of those projects, and it is return money on the state investment.
Thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, that's what I was going to say. Thank you for that clarification.
See no further questions. Thank you both.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Twyla Brace. Okay. All right, somebody from the long-term care imperative. I see a few interested faces.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Patty Cullen with Care Providers of Minnesota speaking on behalf of the long-term care imperative. I came before this committee several weeks ago talking about the various case mix proposals that were before the committee, and based on what's in the budget, I think that was unsuccessful, so I brought real people here. So Sharon Klestis will actually provide our testimony, and I'll just respond to questions later.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you. I represent the Long-Term Care Imperative. And
excuse me, ma'am. Could you please state your name for the record, please?
Sharon Klestis.
Thank you.
I'm here to testify on the impact of the change in the quarterly assessment in relationship to case mix rates and the impact that will have on nursing homes in the state of Minnesota. According to our estimates, this provision is going to decrease operating revenues for nursing facilities by $11.6 million per year. And that's a combination of both MA dollars and private pay dollars. What that means to the average nursing home in the state is a decrease in operating revenue of $29,000, or approximately a 1% decrease in their rates. There will be additional operating expenses that are incurred by facilities as well, because when this occurs, you're doubling the amount of billing procedures that occur. There's going to be software application changes that need to be made. The billing office will be sending out more notices. There will be more meetings with our directors of nurses or the RNs that are delegated to meet with family members who have questions on this. That is projected to cost our nursing homes another $11,600. So those three numbers combined are a loss to the nursing home of $56,000. I think that we have to remember this in the context of the financial situations that our facilities are currently experiencing right now as well. We've had heating costs that have increased 30% this year, or an average of $12,800 per facility, with no way to recoup that expense. We've had life safety code complications from our surveys, the surveyors that are citing facilities, and the average cost for facilities to make those provisions is another $14,800. Again, no way to recover this. And the actual financial status in general of nursing homes in the state, according to Larson Allen Wisher, is declining. Right now, 26% of the nursing homes in the state are at risk of closing, according to their estimations. The average operating margin in 2005 was 0.14%, so basically zero. Median days cash on hand were 16 days. So the implication of this may not seem that dramatic to you, but the impact to our long-term care facilities will be dramatic. And I ask that you take that into consideration as you move forward.
Thank you. It's nice to see real people here. Any clarifying questions, members? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 26% of nursing homes is before this goes into effect?
That's correct. That's based on 2005 information, with nursing homes with a loss of 5% negative, or a negative margin of 5% or greater.
That's the measure. It's okay.
Representative Goodwin.
Oh, I'll let Representative Deacon have asked a lot of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering if there's a breakdown as far as regionally, what the risks are for closure for the nursing homes.
Yes, there is. Do you have that with you? It does vary across the state. The metropolitan area is about 16%. Do you want each region?
Yeah.
Okay. The northwest portion of the state is 25% risk of closure. The northeast portion of the state is 43.5% risk of closure.
Wow.
West central, 25% risk of closure. East central, 28.1% risk of closure. Metro, 15.5%. Southwestern, 42.1% at risk of closure. Southeastern portion of the state, 24.5% risk of closure. I might just add a note that the reason we believe the metropolitan area is less is because many nursing homes have already closed in the metropolitan area.
Representative Goodwin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to ask you how this compares, this proposal and this bill compares with the governor's proposal for nursing homes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin. The governor didn't have anything in his budget on this. There is a agency bill that Representative Samuelson carried that went separately on its own. I think it's budget neutral. That has language in there that deals with the case mix assessment piece, but does so with a language at the bottom that says it has to be a budget neutral for each facility effect. So there is nothing in the governor's budget.
Thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Collin or whomever, if we could follow up. I didn't quite follow all of the math. We have just a little under $2 million effect in this biennium. I realize that with medical assistance match, that becomes $4 million. But I didn't quite figure, and I don't want to take the committee's time now, but I think the number that was given was 11.6, and I can't figure out how to work that. So if you could provide me a sheet with the details of how that's worked up, appreciate it.
Ms. Collin?
Certainly could do so. Just a brief comment here. We have more private pay dollars that we lose with this, so it's not a 50-50 match with that, but we can give you the background data that you need.
All right. Thank you both. Next, Jeff Barsh from Health Partners. Welcome to the committee. You know the routine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I'm here today representing Health Partners. I do want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. Schedules and timelines get very hectic around this time of the year, and so I really do want to thank the committee and staff for providing this bill ahead of time, giving the public a chance to review it, and then also for providing an opportunity to testify. That's not always the case around here, so we do appreciate it. I'd like to thank the committee for a number of positive steps taken in this legislation to address health care costs and health insurance costs, particularly a number of provisions in Article 5 of the bill that are aimed to increase transparencies on health care cost information. There are provisions that deal with price transparency for clinicians, hospitals, and also health plans, and we do feel that all these measures are important steps to take as we continue to try and arm consumers with tools to address the issue of rising health care costs. I want to thank the committee for their work and their continued diligence to address the issue of health care costs in Minnesota. On that issue, we also believe that in Section 2 of the bill, or Article 2, I'm sorry, Section 84 of the bill, there's language to make sure and ensure choice for Minnesotans in greater Minnesota in their government program services. This is language that was recommended by the Department of Human Services, which makes changes to sole source purchasing by counties, and we do support that. In Article 2, Section 4 of the bill, we'd also like to echo the comments of the Minnesota Dental Association in regards to the Critical Access Dental Program. We do feel it's appropriate in the language defining how to calculate payments for the Critical Access Dental providers is important. We view the language in the bill as a recognition by the committee that this is an important program, but like the Dental Association, we'd hope that the funding would be included. If there was one area of the bill which we would have liked to see a little more emphasis, it would have been in the area of mental health reform. The bill does acknowledge the crisis of mental health access by including language that requires the commissioner to study the issue and make recommendations to improve the structural financing and organizational problems in our mental health system. Setting the issue is very important, and we need to continue to do so. But we would suggest that there has been a good amount of study done and some recommendations made by an important group over the last couple of years. We do support those recommendations improving access for our mental health system. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that's all my comments at this time. Again, thank you and the staff for your hard work in putting this legislation together and for the opportunity to testify. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, members. Clarifying questions. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you. You can just expect it, can't you? I wanted to ask about, thank you, Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask about the mental health portion of this. And you said, I heard you say that, you know, that there was another study requested, and that's true. And there already have been, haven't there been three studies, or at least in the last 3 years, this issue has been studied? And we pretty much know what the recommendations are and what we're supposed to do on it, don't we?
Sparks.
Your opinion from the health care provider's perspective.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Goodwin, what I was speaking to specifically was a report and a study done by the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group over the last couple of years and recommendations that came forward out of that group, which was included in the governor's supplemental budget proposal.
And then, Mr. Chair, did I hear you say that you support the transfer of mental health services from the county to the health to the private health and care?
Ms. Brush.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, that is one piece of the reform proposal. We hadn't taken a specific position on that piece. The underlying reason for that is to integrate physical and mental health, which we agree is a good thing to do for patients who have mental health problems. We'd be the first ones to recognize that changing that type of delivery system would be a challenge for anyone, and so we hadn't taken a position on that particular piece. We would say if that language or if that was that initiative were to move forward, we'd have to work very closely with the counties to see that services were continue to be provided in an appropriate way.
Okay, and a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair. The health maintenance organizations have really decreased the amount of work they're doing in mental health and the amount of mental health that's available for people who need it. How would this kind of a transfer work to encourage you to provide more mental health services instead of less? I mean, instead of the lack of mental health care that we have now.
Mr. Brush.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I would respectfully disagree with the notion that mental health services have been decreased through the managed care organizations. I can be happy to provide you with some follow-up information on that. In regards to how we would increase services, or I guess would provide the services that the counties currently do if those requirements were placed on the health plans, we would look at it as a contract obligation we'd have with the Department of Human Services and our need to fulfill that contract.
And final question, do you remember what the governor had proposed for mental health? Because we've heard a lot of before session and during session about how much we're going to be doing for mental health. And I don't know for sure what, I know there's not much in this bill at all for mental health. And I don't blame Representative Bradley for that. I believe the governor got a lot of headlines and great editorials, but he didn't fund mental health. But I don't know what amount I guess I've got governor's recs here, but I believe there wasn't much recommended and only about, maybe I should ask Representative Bradley this, only about $100,000 in actual mental health services. I mean, not counting additional positions, and perhaps somebody can answer that for me. What is actually the dollar amount that we're getting for mental health in here, and how does that compare with the governor?
All right, Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The governor proposed about $3.4 million in this biennium and $46 million in the next biennium in the overall mental health transformation proposal.
Mm-hmm.
We are proposing $100,000 in terms of study and plan.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Representative Goodwin.
Chair, so in other words, well, $3.4 million is kind of a drop in the bucket, but now all we're getting out of that then is $100,000 for a study for mental health. That's all we're doing for mental health then, basically. That's it.
Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, well, notwithstanding, again, reminder that we are in a biennial budget, and if you looked at our MA budgets and Minnesota Care budgets and others, you would find a significant expenditure that is directed at mental health services also, and that's already existing. But in terms of the supplemental, keep in mind, of course, and I have, when we come back, I have a question for the testifier on this, because the governor did propose to take all this in the health care access fund as well.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Bradley, question for Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barsha, how do you, what's your position on using the health care access fund, $46 million in the next biennium, for this initiative? You propose we should be doing it.
Mr. Rush.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, we believe that the money in the health care access fund is to be utilized for health care services, and we believe that the recommendations to increase mental health, or access to mental health services that were in the government's proposal are fall within those lines.
All right, see no further clarifying questions. Thank you. We'll move on to Chris Flatton. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
I apologize if I screwed that up. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Chris Flatton. We still use the Norwegian pronunciation. I chair the Minnesota State Advisory Council on Mental Health, and I've been doing advocacy about mental health issues for over 15 years now. My testimony today concerns Section 4, starting with page 11 point and line 3, and I want to express my disappointment in the lack of funding allocated for mental health service delivery and finance reform. There are some things that money can't fix. My cousin died last July from complications related to his mental illness. He was 57 years old. He never managed to live independently and for the most part lived with his mother. He never had a job, never had a girlfriend. During the last 9 months of his life, he went through more than $100,000 of his mother's money, mostly on hotels, bar tabs, fines, and attorneys. Money wasn't the issue in that family, but money couldn't fix my cousin. I have known at least 10 people who have died by suicide. I know the families and friends of many others who have either come close to death or have died. The situations and circumstances have all been different. Some have been wealthy, some poor, some well-educated, some less educated, some young, some old, some newly diagnosed or never treated, some lived with their illness for 20, 30 years before dying. There are some things that money can't fix. But money can fix the fragmented mental health system, a problem not just in Minnesota, but across the nation, as reported by the President's new Freedom Commission report on mental health. Money can be used to build an infrastructure, a system through which people can access the care they need at appropriate times. Money can be used to maintain a system that supports people and their families who live with these devastating illnesses. With appropriate services, treatments, and supports, many people will have lives that are rich and meaningful, lives in which they have satisfying relationships with friends and family members and contribute to their communities through their work, payment of taxes, participation in activities. Reform to the mental health system is too late for my cousin, and in at least some ways, it's too late for me. But it's not too late for our nieces and nephews, for your children and your grandchildren. It's not too late for our neighbors. So I urge you, even implore you, to fully fund the governor's proposal with the $50 million in new money. The time is right. We have national support for these efforts from the President's new Freedom Commission. Governor Pawlenty spoke publicly about how this mental health initiative would touch the lives of everyone in Minnesota. Commissioner Goodnow and his staff have worked hard on this as a priority. The State Advisory Council on Mental Health and Subcommittee on Children's Mental Health voted unanimously to support the direction of the Governor's Mental Health Initiative. And as I'm sure Representative Bradley remembers, who was a member of our council, a unanimous vote is quite rare. We have a diverse group of stakeholders who, through the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, have worked on these issues for the past 2.5 years. Money can't fix broken hearts, can't heal my aunt's grief. but money can build and maintain a mental health system that responds appropriately to people's needs. Please give us that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, clarifying questions? See none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the list, Louise Brown. Okay. We'll move on to Dawn Simonson. Simonson? Is there a group that wanted to testify together? Okay. Is there one more? Do we need another chair?
Yep. No chair.
Grab a chair. Yeah, perfect.
Pull a chair over here, Don.
Good. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then go ahead.
Thank you very much. My name is Sandra Anderson. I am the vice chair of the Minnesota Board on Aging.
I'm Connie Bagley, the Executive Director of the Area Agency on Aging in Rochester.
And Don Simonson, the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Area Agency on Aging.
Welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much for agreeing to hear us tonight. We appreciate that. We're here for two main reasons. The first is to clarify something that we heard. In the current budget, there's $575,000 that's been provided through April 15th. Under the payer of last resort, and that's for drugs for people who are considered dual eligible. None of that money is available to the senior linkage line, and that's what we're actually here to talk about tonight. But I wanted to be sure that you understood that. The senior linkage line is the statewide information and assistance service of the Minnesota Board on Aging and its area agencies on aging. It serves as the gateway for long-term care planning and information. 1-800-333-2433 is available in all 87 counties of Minnesota. We have call centers in Warren, Fergus Falls, Duluth, St. Cloud, Slayton, Rochester, and St. Paul. Prior to last fall, the Linkage Line's primary focus was helping people remain independent and live in their communities. On average, the Linkage Line received 7,000 contacts per month. Since November 15, 2005, the Linkage Line received more than 7,000 contacts per week. This was when Medicare Part D enrollment began. The Minnesota Board on Aging is the designated SHIP counselor for Minnesota, so it's incumbent upon us to deal with issues that concern insurance, Medicare Part D, and all of those things. It's a 64% increase in contacts from 2004 and 5. This trend continues in 2006. Since last fall, Medicare Part D has dramatically altered the work of the Linkage Line. We've shifted all of our existing resources to Medicare Part D. We've received short-term funding to help increase our staffing. The Linkage Line is operating at maximum capacity with its current funding. Call center hours have been extended to evenings and weekends. Part D has overwhelmed the current Linkage Line system. Virtually all current work happening is on Part D. The primary focus of Part D work has been working with the Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollees. These are called the dual eligibles, the former Minnesota Prescription Drug Program enrollees, and long-term care residents. There's extensive problem solving involved here. The duals cost sharing amounts are incorrect. The duals are not in the system as having a Part D plan. Long-term care residents are charged co-pays. The duals are in the system, but with the wrong plan. This goes on and on. Connie will now speak about some of the direct problems.
To date, we now have approximately 40% of those who are eligible to enroll in Part D that have not enrolled in Part D, so the job is not done yet. Along with the difficulties that we're having with people who are enrolled, we will have work that will continue on into the next year because we are dealing with 72 formularies that are allowed to change their formularies on a monthly basis. The enrollees that are dual may also change their enrollment on a monthly basis. The enrollments are enrollment and disenrollment involve a lot of work on the phone and extensive work on the part of the senior linkage staff. In addition to that, we are also now dealing with exceptions and with appeals that are very lengthy and involved and take up a great deal of our time. There are billing errors, and we are now finding that the calls, in order to clear up the difficulties for individuals, is taking between 20 and 45 minutes per person. We need to continue to work with the extra staff that we have currently as a result of the funding that we had for Medicare Part D, and we're here today to encourage you to rethink and include that in this budget for the next biennium. We are looking for providing informed assistance with our senior linkage callers. We have not been able to keep up with the work that we normally do on the senior linkage line, which includes providing assistance for caregivers, making available services to people and connecting them with services, identifying housing options, transportation services, and providing counseling to families in order to make decisions about caregiving for their family members. So we're very concerned that although many people may think that it's over with, that this is not the situation with Medicare Part D, and we anticipate that the ongoing problems with Medicare Part D will be ongoing for at least another year and a half to 2 years.
Just going to focus my testimony on the numbers of people that we estimate will not be served if the Medicare Part D implementation, enrollment, and access funding isn't provided and the resulting consequences. And please keep in mind I'm speaking only for the 7-county metropolitan region, but that the call volume to the Metro Linkage Line does represent approximately half of the service statewide. In the metro region between October 2005 and March 2006, we served approximately 47,000 persons one-on-one over the linkage line. The average call length is about 30 minutes, and that includes talking with the person as well as the follow-up work that we need to do with health plans and pharmacists, as well as reporting such as filing required reports with the federal government related to Medicare fraud, waste, and abuse. In the metro, on any given month during that time period, we had an average of 500 to 700 calls over an hour in length. These are very complicated issues for people, result in work with the person calling as well as collateral calls to others to help solve the person's problem or provide very comprehensive assistance in helping help counseling them to make the very best enrollment decision. Our best estimates are that between July and December of 2006, should the Medicare Part D funding not be available at the levels that it currently is, we would estimate that in the metro 10,900 persons would not be served, and we would estimate that in calendar year 2007 that 26,700 persons in the metro will not be served. The consequences, particularly for dually eligible Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries who are primarily frail, poor, older women, will be that there is no other neutral resource for information and counseling about Medicare Part D plans. This can result in reduced access to prescription drugs, which may result in health care crises or deterioration of chronic conditions. This, in turn, can result in increased hospitalization, increased utilization of emergency room care, and unnecessary nursing home placements, all potentially resulting in greater costs to the state, particularly the state's share of the Medicaid program. So our request tonight is that the committee reconsider and include the governor's recommended budget for Part D implementation, enrollment, and access. That amount is for 2006-2007 is $1.25 million and ongoing at $1.15 million. Thank you. We'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you all. Members, clarifying questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I did have one question, Mr. Chairman.
Oh. Hold tight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is that people that are calling about getting help with caregiving and those types of issues aren't, you don't have the capacity to serve those folks?
We've been so focused on the Part D that our calls for those kinds of things haven't even been able to get through the numbers of calls that we've been having on Part D. And so we continue to see those calls on Part D kind of pull back our ability to provide the other service.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Sam Goodman.
Thank you. And what was the difference between the governor's recommendations and this committee's recommendations?
I believe there is no money in the budget. The omnibus bill does not include money. And the governor's budget did include funding from the state Medicare Part D funding.
Rep. Sam Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could repeat the numbers, the governor's budget had almost $2 million in it in this current biennium, and I thought I heard you say something like $1.25
There is a $500,000 provision for emergency funding between that would have been a special request of the governor to be spent by the end of June 2006. But the dollars going forward are 1.25 for 06 and 07 and 1.15 ongoing.
Representative Bradley.
I'm sure I can follow up. I see the line. There is one line in the budget, and the overall is more than that, but you were not counting the 2006, because I kind of wondered about 2006. By the time that money is available, it almost seems too late for that part.
Correct.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, seeing no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Members, the Minnesota Hospital Association handed out, I believe, their testimony, so... Just want to acknowledge that I think the testifier had to leave, so we have this in your hands. We will go down to then Twyla Brace. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for going back on the schedule since I wasn't here exactly when you called my name. I'm just going to mention a few things. Four things actually. One having to do with the Healthcare Access Fund, another having to do with policy concerns with the studies that are towards the end of the bill, the evidence-based medicine section, and then two other things that are very close together. I'll just say first about the Healthcare Access Fund. It's a concern of ours that the uses of the fund continue to expand, and they are moving now, as I understand it, there are four places here, at least that I can see. One at the very end of the bill where it talks about transfers, and essentially the use of the Healthcare Access Fund goes up about 30%. That can be transferred to the general fund. It's also transferred to MSHA. And in one of the studies, one of the things that's being looked at is transferring the money to expand clinics and centers. And that, of course, was never what the Healthcare Access Fund was meant for. It's primarily a tax on patients and patient care, and then practitioners who can't get it from those who they get payments from. And then I'm going to go to our policy concerns with the studies. Those studies are on page, let me make sure I've got it here, page 107, starting at line 13, and then the other study, that's the one related to universal participation and access to care. And the other study has to do with the provider pricing fairness, which starts on page 108, line 12. The concern I'm going to point out on page 107, line 22, with that study, besides the fact of studying to use the Healthcare Access Fund for building or expanding clinics and centers, it's also this idea of increasing availability of services by giving patients access to physician assistants, nurse practitioners, medical residents, interns, and other allied health professionals. And it's not to say that that doesn't give them access to services, but it doesn't necessarily give them access to physician care, and it should never be looked at as though the two of them are the same. The training, I'm a nurse, the training is significantly different between those who are physicians and those who are some of these other services here. All fine practitioners, but if a patient wants or needs a doctor, that doesn't give them access to physician services. And then the other study has to do with the provider pricing fairness, and it's a concern that looking at a proposal that state law would prohibit healthcare providers from varying the amount that they accept as full payment. What we'd really like to do is expand the ability of individuals to actually charge different prices, have it be a real market. If you look at the cosmetic surgery or eye surgery today, that is the exact thing that happens. And so there really are different practitioners out there, and there are different amounts of money that people who care would pay for those practitioners. So to look at the possibility of having a law that absolutely prohibits different charges is not moving towards a free market, but moving away. And then I'll mention on evidence-based medicine, which your committee has heard from me before on my concerns that this is really standardizing the practice of medicine and making it difficult for patients to be treated as individuals. I do want you to note in the criteria for evidence-based guidelines that there's two things. One, there's nothing about it being for the individual. And the other thing is that in page 99, line 3, it says here that authors must represent all pertinent clinical fields or other means of input have been used. And, you know, I was just talking to someone out on the road who has a he was leaving and I was coming, has a significant healthcare problem, and says one doctor told him they didn't use steroids anymore. And he went back to his doctor and said, well, the studies differ. So last year you had the performance reporting law, it's reporting of physicians according to evidence-based medicine. This is still not going to provide and tends to take us the direction away from individualized care. And then the last thing that I'll talk about is on page 102. Well, actually, 101, the small health plan purchasing pool. Just to say that really, you know, I don't know that this is necessary because it's another expense when individuals could actually negotiate on their own, and I know from personal experience physicians do negotiate. And then on 102, the discounted payments by healthcare providers, I just want to say that that's a very good thing to do, especially to allow the usual customary certain things not to count, including discounts for cash payments. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Clarifying questions? Seeing none, thanks. All right, members, that concludes the list of public testimony that we have. Representative Bradley, do you have any announcements? Or
No, I wonder if we shouldn't at least ask if perhaps by a show of hands if there's anybody else sure. That was here that wished to.
Sure. Does anybody in the audience wish to testify?
Okay.
All right.
Then Mr. Chair, I think your agenda shows tomorrow morning at 10:15, we will take action on the bill, handle amendments, discuss, and ultimately vote on the bill.
All right. Thank you. Members, have a good evening. This meeting is adjourned.